As war rages in Europe, what's the status of Russia's relationship with China? This is Brief Before Impact. Hey, welcome everyone, and welcome to this episode today. We're going to be talking about the relationship between China and Russia in this kind of perilous time with war in Ukraine. We've seen early on, you know, China's comments and kind of how they've played a neutral stance to the situation, playing this very close to the chest and diplomatically, not criticizing overtly Russia or necessarily playing into any type of Western narrative. So what I wanted to do for today's episode is give you an idea of, first, China's rise to power. You know, kind of looking back since the early 1970s as the United States started to engage more with China, and move on to, secondly, the timeline up to the recent invasion in Ukraine, and lastly, kind of evaluate some ways that China and Russia are allied, and kind of what we can make of that relationship in any future military conflicts, whether it's this one in Ukraine or perhaps a Chinese invasion in Taiwan. Last thing before we take a quick ad break, I want to encourage everyone to continue to stay just on top of the news reports that come out on the fighting in Ukraine. Just find a good resource that you like. One of the news outlets out there, I suggest finding something both right of center and left of center and just kind of making your own judgments. That's what I do, frankly. I read both news written by political conservatives as well as political liberals. And I think it's a good thing. Like, I want a holistic view. This podcast generally is never going to be that kind of daily news update. On the contrary, I only do an episode a week. I'm not fit to do that. You've got full-time reporters who give you terrific resources. What I want this episode and this podcast to be generally for you is an insight on some more greater large scheme strategic issues and how they all come together in these tactical geopolitical events that we witness on TV, and most importantly, how this affects my life, your life, and the lives of our families. So with that, let me take a quick ad break and then we'll get started. All right, welcome back everyone. I want to first start off with kind of evaluating the rise to power that Chinese Communist Party and the nation of China has seen, especially since the 1970s. All right, so let's do a little bit of a history lesson. Year's 1971. America was right in the middle of Vietnam, very frustrating Vietnam War, and President Nixon is in office. And he announces to the American people that he's going to be visiting China in 1972. Now, in Vietnam, the war in Vietnam, it was the Soviets, not the Chinese, that had become the most significant supporters of the North Vietnamese regime. And the war in Vietnam, it wasn't going well. The American people were impatient for an end to the conflict, and it was becoming increasingly apparent that the United States might not be able to save its ally, South Vietnam, from its communist aggressors. According to History.com, Nixon's trip to China, therefore, was a move that was calculated to drive an even deeper wedge between the two most significant communist powers. It's obviously the Soviet Union and China. The United States could use closer diplomatic relations with China as leverage in dealing with the Soviets, particularly on the issue of Vietnam. In addition, the United States might be able to make use of the Chinese as a counterweight to North Vietnam. Now, despite their claims of socialist solidarity, China and North Vietnam were, at best, strongly suspicious allies. As a matter of fact, historian Walter Lefebvre was quoted saying, "Instead of using Vietnam to contain China, Nixon concluded that he had better use China to contain Vietnam." So for its part, China was desirous of another ally in its increasingly tense relationship with the Soviet Union, and certainly welcomed the possibility of an increased, you know, United States-China trade. So it was in the 70s that we started engaging the Chinese on a more diplomatic and economic relationship, which leads me to how they became kind of, for lack of better words, the world's manufacturing hub. So in addition to its low labor cost, China has become known as, frankly, the world's factory because of its strong business ecosystem, lack of regulatory compliance, low taxes, and load duties, and competitive currency practices. Now, according to data published by the United Nations Statistics Division, China accounted for more than 28.7% of global manufacturing output in 2019. That puts the country more than 10 percentage points ahead of the United States for manufacturing, which we used to have the world's largest manufacturing sector until China overtook it in 2010. Now, it's been about 20 years since China entered the global trade body, known as the World Trade Organization, which is a move that gave it access to the international trade system. The question is, was it worth it? So there's some officials and lawmakers that have regrets, arguing that kind of China's gain from the WTO entry back in 2001 came at an unfair cost to the U.S. economy. According to Politico, China's WTO accession has rendered the United States undeniable gains. You know, consumers have enjoyed two decades of relatively inexpensive imported consumer goods, which boosted their buying power and the economy. You know, there's an analysis in 2019 by the London School of Economics of the impact of China's WTO entry and that impact on the U.S. consumer prices. And this analysis concluded that, quote, each U.S. household saw its annual purchasing power increase by $1,500 thanks to lower prices caused by increased trade with China from the year 2000 to 2007. So that's with this engagement from the United States in the early 70s and now utilizing China for its large population and business ecosystem to become the world's factory. Let's talk about the man at the helm, President Xi Jinping. Look at his background and essentially what his vision is and how it's become implemented into the modern Chinese Communist Party. According to BBC, because of his illustrious roots, Mr. Xi is seen as a princeling, a child of elite senior officials who has risen up in the ranks. His dad was a really big shot in the Communist Party back in the day. But his family fortunes took a dramatic turn when his father was actually purged in 1962 prior to the Cultural Revolution, and then he was imprisoned. So far from turning against the Communist Party, Mr. Xi actually embraced it. He tried to join it several times, but was rebuffed because of who his father was. Now, once he finally was accepted in 1974 into the party, he worked hard to rise to the top. At first, as a local party secretary in the Hebei province, before moving on to more senior roles in other places, and that included the party chief in Shanghai, China's second city and financial hub. Now, his increasing profile in the party propelled him to its top decision-making body, the Politburo Standing Committee, and in 2012, he was picked as president. Now, Mr. Xi has vigorously pursued what he has called a great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation with his China Dream vision. Under him, China has enacted economic reform to combat slowing growth. So, for example, cutting down bloated state-owned industries and reducing pollution, as well as its One Belt, One Road trade project. You've heard me talk about this in other episodes. This has been accompanied by a resurgence in patriotic nationalism whipped up by state media, with a particular focus on Mr. Xi as China's strongman, leading some to accuse him of developing a personality cult, kind of like that of Mao. In a clear sign of his influence, the Communist Party voted in 2017 to write his philosophy, called the Xi Jinping Thought on Socialism with Chinese Characteristics for the New Era. They wrote it into the Constitution. Under Mr. Xi, China has seen increasing clampdowns on freedoms, from rising online censorship to arrest of dissidents and human rights lawyers, leading some to describe Mr. Xi as the most authoritarian leader since Chairman Mao. And the clampdowns have only intensified. Under his leadership, China has also focused on Taiwan, threatening to use military force to prevent any move towards formal independence there. And Beijing views Taiwan as a breakaway province, but Democratic Taiwan sees itself as a sovereign state. So we've evaluated the engagement the United States has started with China in the 1970s. now moving to become the world's manufacturing hub of the world. And is it lastly, President Xi's philosophy and where he is moving towards for the future of China. Let's evaluate and move on to how the recent invasion in Russia, the recent invasion from Russia into Ukraine has been seen by the Chinese Communist Party and kind of the rhetoric and narrative that they've used to describe Russia and the relationship. So let's go back to a timeline. We're actually going to go back a little bit over into the early 2000s to kind of understand why, in fact, Putin thought he had the green light, so to speak, to invade Ukraine in the first place. Let's start with the Russo-Georgian War. Now, this is a war between Georgia, which is a Caucasus state. Look it up on the map. It's just south of Russia. Between Georgia, Russia, and the Russian-backed self-proclaimed republics of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Now, this war took place in August 2008, following a period of just worsening relations between Russia and Georgia, both formerly constituent republics of the Soviet Union. The fighting took place in the strategically important Transcaucasia region, and it's regarded, this war at least, as the first European war in the 21st century. Let's move fast forward to 2014. We're all aware of the annexation of Crimea. In February and March of 2014, Russia invaded and subsequently annexed the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. This event took place in the aftermath of the Revolution of Dignity in Ukraine and is part of the wider Russo-Ukrainian War. Let's move forward to 2020. In Hong Kong, June 30th, 2020, China introduced a national security law in Hong Kong in response to massive pro-democracy protests that had swept through the city the previous year. The controversial law reduces Hong Kong's judicial autonomy and makes it easier to punish demonstrators and activists, according to the BBC. It criminalizes secession, subversion, and collusion with foreign forces and carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. And since it was enacted, more than 100 people, including protesters, pro-democracy politicians, and journalists, have been arrested under its provisions. Let's move forward into just last summer, an Afghanistan withdrawal. Russian officials quickly seized the opportunity to use the United States' withdrawal from Afghanistan as fodder for political messaging about failed U.S. nation building. August 20th last year, Putin made explicit statements along these lines, and he commented, quote, "It is necessary to stop the irresponsible policy of imposing other people's values from outside, the desire to build democracy in other countries, not taking into account either historical, national, or religious characteristics, and completely ignoring the traditions by which people live. Any such socio-political experiments have never been crowned with the success and only lead to destruction of states and the degradation of their political and social systems." When you imagine like a very powerful leader of a nation state like Russia or China for that matter, and you think about the timeline of these events that I just laid out, there has been a slow testing of the waters by these two countries to see what the West would do, or how the West views itself, broadly speaking, in terms of global power. And based upon the observations made by both Russia and China, specifically with Putin, it's my opinion that he was receiving signals that nothing probably would happen that much if he invaded Ukraine. That was, I think, the signals the Biden administration and Western powers were sending him. That was a miscalculation by Putin. He didn't expect, in my opinion, the West to rally like it has with weapons. Just read recently they're sending fighter jets to Ukraine, which is a huge move. And this brings us to kind of how China has evaluated this whole policy and what maybe role they played in the background prior to it. The Olympics just happened, as you all know. So according to Reuters, Putin arrived in Beijing for the 2022 Winter Olympics. He had met with President Xi Jinping, actually brought him a deal to increase natural gas supplies to China amid this rising tension, with the West. Now, Putin told Xi that Russia had prepared a new deal to supply China with additional 10 billion cubic meters of natural gas. And that was according to a broadcast of their talks aired in Moscow. And Russia and China coordinated their positions on Ukraine during a meeting between their foreign ministers, Wang Yi and Sergei Lavrov. And that was in Beijing. That was according to the Chinese foreign ministry. Now, in response, the United States warned Chinese firms, companies, that they would face consequences if they sought to evade export controls imposed on Russia in the event of it invading Ukraine. So there was building up to the invasion in Ukraine by Russian forces. There was plenty of back and forth at the highest levels between China and Russia discussing such an invasion and how that relationship moving forward would look like. In the early days of the invasion, what was China's demeanor? What was the rhetoric? It was a very diplomatic tone, not really jumping for one side or the other, always kind of playing its cards very close to the chest. According to the New York Times article, a Western intelligence report said senior Chinese officials told Russian officials in early February not to invade Ukraine before the end of the Winter Olympics in Beijing. That was according to a senior Biden administration officials and a European official. The report indicates that senior Chinese officials had some level of direct knowledge of Russia's war plans or intentions before the invasion started. Now, Putin met with Xi Jinping, we know this, back on February 4th, before the opening ceremony of the Olympics. Now, Moscow and Beijing issued a 5,000-word statement at the time, declaring the partnership had, quote, no limits, denouncing NATO enlargement, and asserting that they would establish a new global order with true democracy. Since the war began, Chinese officials have consistently sided with Russia. They have expressed support for Russia's concern about NATO and spoken of sovereignty in ambiguous terms. Again, kind of coming back to never really devoting themselves to one side or the other, just supporting an ally in an ambiguous way. A Chinese government readout of a telephone conversation, actually, between Mr. Xi and Mr. Putin reiterated those points. Spokespeople for the Chinese foreign ministry have refused to call Russia's actions an invasion and blame the United States for inflaming tensions around Ukraine. Now, China has also criticized the sanctions imposed on Russia by the United States and the European nations, and other European nations. Now, Wang Wenbin, he's a foreign ministry spokesman for China, said to a news conference in Beijing that Russia and Ukraine should seek a political solution that accommodates the legitimate security concerns of both sides. So we've got this history of small and significant incursions and invasions into other countries by both Russia and China. A buildup to those things, a withdrawal from Afghanistan, kind of a very much a stain on the United States and in a foreign policy perspective. Russia and China maneuvering during the Olympics before and during and after on kind of the next moves for Ukraine. So how close is China and Russia? Like, what ties do they really have? Obviously, we know the Chinese Communist Party, former Soviet Union, deeply communist country. Obviously, Putin was a former KGB agent. He is a communist at heart. So, but beyond just an ideology, what ties do they actually have between the two countries? Let's talk about economic ties, military, and finally, just the United Nations being used as a tool for promoting this, the diminishing of the liberal world order led by the United States. So starting with economic ties between China and Russia, according to the South China Morning Post, economic relations between Russia and China demonstrate mixed trends. Trade between the two countries was running between $5 to $8 billion per year in the 1990s, but actually grew steadily from then onwards. And it was on course to hit $100 billion until the 2008 crisis interceded. So trade then slumped back right about $60 billion in 2015 and 16, but then started to recover again. And both countries are expected to raise the trade volume to $200 billion by 2024. And the main form of cooperation in this kind of complex economic relations between Russia and China is trade. From 2003 to 2013, mutual trade increased 7.7 times. And in 2014, the scale of bilateral operations increased even more. the aggravation of relations between Russia and Western countries contributed to that expansion of economic ties with China. By 2020, the parties plan to increase that bilateral trade significantly up to $200 billion. This is what I mean when we're looking at why countries work together. The ideology of Xi and Putin, they might have some overlaps, but they are certainly different men with different goals for themselves and their countries. They will work together where they have mutual interest. We'll keep that common thread in mind when we're thinking about the ties these two countries have together. Let's quickly look at their military ties and how those two countries' militaries have operated together. According to Vladimir Shenkov from the Associated Press, Russia's defense chief has signed a roadmap for closer military ties with China, pointing to increasingly frequent U.S. strategic bomber flights near both countries' borders. During a video call between the defense minister of Russia, Sergei Shoigu, and his Chinese counterpart, Wei Fenghe, Shoigu expressed a shared interest in stepping up strategic military exercises and joint patrols by Russia and China. That's according to the Russian Defense Ministry. Now, Shoigu pointed to increasingly intensive flights by the U.S. strategic bombers near Russian borders. He actually said that there was 30 such missions over the past month alone. And quote, in such an environment, the Russian-Chinese coordination becomes a stabilizing factor in global affairs. Now, Wei praised Russia for successfully countering what he described as U.S. pressure and military threats. Shoigu and Wei held a series of maneuvers that involved Russian and Chinese warplanes and naval ships and assigned a plan of military cooperation between 2021 and 25. Now, Putin and Xi Jinping have developed strong personal ties just to bolster a strategic partnership between former communist rivals as they both face tensions in the West. Now, according to the Military Times, Russia has sought to expand ties between China as its relations with the U.S. and its allies sank to post-Cold War lows over Moscow's 2014 annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Now, accusations of Russian hacking attacks and interference in elections and other disputes. Even though Russia and China in the past rejected the possibility of forging a military alliance, Putin said last year that such a prospect can't be ruled out. He also noted that Russia has been sharing highly sensitive military technologies with China that helped significantly bolster its defense capability. So with its economic and military ties laid out, let's turn the focus to how China specifically has used these international organizations like the UN, the United Nations, to position itself to the world as trying to be an honest broker, where in fact it's anything but. But it's the nature of these institutions that allows China to do so. And almost goes back to the 1970s and the engagement between China and the United States under the Nixon administration with this fundamental or this belief that engagement with China, inviting them to the World Trade Organization, inviting them to become a member of the international community, would in fact turn them away from the deeply held communist ideologies and more westernize their beliefs, allowing them to have a more open market and open society for its large population to enjoy. In some ways, obviously, its economic gains have been substantial, but the belief that its ideological roots could be changed merely by free trade was just overblown and oversold, to say the least. So according to The Diplomat, China's greater leadership role in the United Nations has triggered the suspicion that it might take advantage to transform the organization in ways that fit its interest. The suspicion about China's expanding role in the UN, it has solid foundations, as Beijing has been assimilating its grand geopolitical agenda, for example, the Belt and Road Initiative, into the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And this is silencing the critics of its human rights record, providing monetary incentives to secure the support of other member states and bringing more of its nationals into the UN. Now, China has been promoting its Belt Road Initiative under the guise of these kind of sustainable development goals, Liu Jianmin, the incumbent head of the DESA, openly claimed that the Belt Road Initiative serves the objectives of the Sustainable Development Goals at a high-level symposium. The fact that DESA has also endorsed the China-funded program, the Jointly Building Belt and Road Towards the Sustainable Development Goals. This is approving the Belt Roads Initiative's effect of achieving those goals. So the United Nations, for example, they promote these different programs. One of them is to have the Sustainable Development Goals. China is, under the guise of considering itself still a developing nation, trying to position itself as this global power and benefiting from certain rules and conditions that more developed nations like the United States and Western Europe they have to endure versus China does not. So besides appealing to member states with authoritarian predispositions, China provides economic incentives in exchange for the leadership in the United Nations. Prior to the election of the ninth director general of the Food and Agricultural Organization in 2019, China slashed $78 million in debt owed to the Cameroonian government, whose nominated candidate coincidentally withdrew his bid afterward. Meanwhile, China failed to control and contain an outbreak of the African swine fever, threatening global food security by causing international transmission across Asia and Europe, with millions of pigs buried alive. Now, nevertheless, Qu Dongyu, the Chinese candidate, was later elected as the first Chinese national to hold that post, the post of the Director General of Food and Agricultural Organization. Regardless of the electoral controversy and the food security crisis originating from his home country. So if that doesn't sound like a quick story of, well, that doesn't make sense. Why would the UN allow this to happen? Why would such an overt corruption be allowed to go through? This is the kind of one of the criticisms that many have of this type of international organization. Now, last thought here, most notably, obviously COVID-19 costing, thousands of lives, millions at this point, outside of its place of origin, which was China. International media now look to Taiwan's model of disease control as the country successfully prevented mass infection despite being one of the first to report confirmed cases. Now, it was an undeniable fact that the WHO, the World Health Organization, has been spreading misleading messages. You've heard my episode about this before. If you haven't, go back. I suggest understanding a little more about what the WHO is and how it's been in many ways bought by the Chinese Communist Party. Now, Secretary General Tedros, he's the head of the WHO, he repeatedly suggested that member states don't need to impose a ban on travel from China. He praised China's belated heavy-handed measures and downplayed the severity of the outbreak right up until it was turned into a pandemic. Tedros' inconsistency in disease control measures and reluctance to criticize China's earlier attempts to cover up the outbreak have damaged the WHO's professional standing, leading some critics to sarcastically rename it the Chinese Health Organization. And this is a problem with international organizations that appear to be unbiased or neutral. You always have to ask the question, if you're watching a story on the news, you're reading an article, who is writing it and what is their agenda? Like in the case of the WHO, the World Health Organization, sounds like a very amicable title. What do they do? Oh, it's all about world health and saving people and so forth and so on, preventing disease outbreak and et cetera. Well, that sounds terrific, but it turns out in the example of a global pandemic like COVID-19, that in fact, it was the influence that the Chinese Communist Party had on WHO that these types of comments were made by its director, basically saying that China had no blame in this whole circumstance, this whole issue with COVID-19. Now, what does that do to normal folks, you and I, who are looking for guidance on issues that are affecting our lives, guidance on this massive virus outbreak of what should we be doing? What can we expect? What can you tell us? What information do you have? And that information is tainted. It is coming through the filter, bent on loyalty to whoever is essentially getting you to those positions. It's unbelievably corrupt. And the fact that this happens to these kind of international organizations whose purpose is to deliver health resolutions and health guidelines for all of humanity to follow in order to save more people. This is why people get frustrated with any type of loyalty to an international organization over its own people. You know, this is why they're hesitant to believe that, you know, a body led by former Portugal's prime minister is better for the people of the world than their own president that they are electing and that person is held accountable to. That's another subject, but this is the problem with China and what they've been doing to these international organizations. And for that matter, countries around the world, I gave you the Cameroonian example, having slashed their debt and then their guy pulling out, not taking the job, and the Chinese guy actually took it. When you have corrupt governments, dictatorships, etc., who are willing to take bribes or be swayed or positions or however, these kind of international institutions lose their credibility when they need it the most, especially in an example where governments and people around the world during the COVID-19 pandemic needed to work together to solve an issue, and their credibility can no longer be trusted. It's a tremendous challenge. Tremendous challenge. And sadly, I think it actually makes the world a more dangerous place, because I think countries then will end up isolating a little bit more rather than engaging abroad and have a more inward-looking viewpoint, which can be challenging for future outbreaks or catastrophes down the road. So just a side thought, but I wanted to share how China has corrupted these organizations and how their ties to the Russia, both economically and militarily, are quite close. At least we know that they're determined for the next 4 to 8 years, both to increase their trade as well as their military engagement, which turns us to our last closing out here of our courses of action. Starting with our most likeliest course of action, the relationship between China and Russia. In my assessment, China and Russia are just going to continue to use one another as partners where their interests are aligned. That being said, loyalty between nation states, it can be lost quickly if actions of one state cross some type of red line for another. And we'll see if any red lines are crossed by Russia in this conflict with Ukraine and see what China does, whether engaging more support to Russia or backing off a little bit. For our most dangerous course of action, in my view, if China were to view this moment in history, Russia invading Ukraine and the West responding, if they viewed it as an opportunity to invade Taiwan, that type of move would escalate tensions in East Asia, likely to levels of leading to direct military conflict between China and the United States and its allies. It's a very tumultuous time in world history, I'd say. One of the first war on the European continent since World War II. And with rising powers in China, we have to be diligent as Americans to understand what our role is in this world. A world led by America's power might offend some people, thinking that no one should be on top and we should all be equal. That's not going to happen. There is always a hierarchy. And in all honesty, despite the flaws our country has and the mistakes we have made abroad, this, in my humble opinion, the most safe world, the one that gives the most opportunity to countries around the world to pursue their own governments, their own types of lifestyles that they want, that type of world is led by the United States in a liberal world order, not by the Chinese Communist Party. So thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and please keep your prayers and thoughts with the people of Ukraine as their country is at war. Hope you're picking up what I am putting down. I am Matt Parker. This is Brief Before Impact.